I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March 11th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance of Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll. Should note that Representative Keeler is excused to be in another committee.
Hanson Rick is present. Wazlowick, Amy.
Wazlowick, present.
Wazlowick, present. Heitzman, Josh.
Present.
Acom, Patty.
Present.
Ackland, Susan.
Present.
Backer, Jeff.
Backer, present.
Beckerfin, Jamie.
Present.
Ackland, Rob.
Present.
Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, present.
Igo, Spencer.
Present.
Jordan, Sydney.
Present.
Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lippert, Tan.
Present.
Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, present.
Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, present.
Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, present.
And Tice, Tama.
Tice, present.
All right, a quorum is present.
Vice Chair Wazlowick will take the gavel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 9th, 2021. Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, I have, and I would move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Nelson moves the minutes for March 9th, 2021. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Minutes are approved. First on the agenda today is House File 214. Representative Lippert, would you like to move that House File 214 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 214 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Lippert, I believe you have an author's amendment as well. Would you please briefly explain the author's amendment?
Sure, Madam Chair. So I move the A1 author's amendment, and this amendment extends the sunset on the Sustainable Forest Resources Act until 2028, and then it also appropriates funds for a study of the state's peatlands. Research is emerging that points to the importance of protecting our peatlands and restoring our peatlands for carbon sequestration. Researchers see this as low-hanging fruit in our work to address climate change, so the study will assess the current state of Minnesota's peatlands, identify current threats and efforts to protect them and restore them, and an estimate of carbon storage provided by peatlands and recommendations for the future.
Representative Lippert moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Lippert, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And in addition to the amendment, House File 214 adds the words natural carbon sequestration, climate resiliency, climate change, and carbon storage to statutes regarding the Forest for the Future program, state nursery operations, Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. The goal here is to have in statute that climate change, resiliency, carbon sequestration, and storage need to be included in the many factors that DNR is taking into account as it manages Minnesota forests. And Doug Tilma is here from the DNR to testify.
All right, I have a couple of testifiers here. We'll go with Mr. Tilma first, and then we'll loop in the other two. Mr. Tilma.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Doug Tilma, DNR Division of Forestry Policy and Planning Section Manager. The bill does two things that I want to testify on today. One is the amendment to reauthorize the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, which is set to expire on June 30th of 2021. This part is in our forestry technical bill this year. The second is to add carbon sequestration as a forest value to a number of statutes that direct DNR programs for state and private forest management. I'll start first with the change regarding carbon sequestration in our forests. Minnesota's forests play an important role in climate change mitigation through sequestration and storage of carbon in trees, forest soils, and in the products harvested from the forest. DNR manages state-administered lands and provides guidance to private landowners for a broad spectrum of forest values, such as wildlife habitat, water quality, forest recreation, forest products, and increasingly climate change mitigation is gaining attention as another important value of our forest lands. DNR seeks to balance all of these forest values so that our management is sustainable and continues to provide these benefits to future generations. DNR is currently working to develop forest management strategies to increase carbon sequestration in our forests. A few of these are reforestation, which is planting new forests on open lands where forests once existed, and quickly reforesting acres after timber harvest. A large percentage of the available open lands are privately owned, and providing guidance to landowners will be a critical step towards increasing our forested lands. Increasing forest productivity on existing forests is another strategy. We do this by increasing the number or species diversity of trees in some forest sites that are not at their fully stocked level today. Keeping forest land as forests is also critical to maintaining the carbon sequestration that we currently have, managing both public and private land so that it becomes adapted to the changing climate and doesn't convert to non-forested conditions under the threat of native or invasive insects and diseases, wildfire, or severe windstorms is an important strategy to keep our forests healthy and able to withstand the changing climate. Next, I want to talk about the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. This bill reauthorizes Chapter 89A, which is all about sustainable forest management. Specifically, the Act provides policies for the state to work in cooperation with public and private sectors to consider a broad array of perspectives and to ensure sustainable management so that our forests provide benefits to future generations. The Act established the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, which assists DNR by providing this broad array of perspectives through its members' diverse interests in our forests. Specifically, the Act describes 8 policies and practices of the Council. I won't go through all of those, but a few of them are to give equal consideration to the long-term economic, ecological, and social needs and limits of the state's forest resources. It fosters the productivity of the forests, state's forests to provide a diversity of sustainable benefits at the site and landscape levels, and it fosters no net loss of forest land in Minnesota. Other parts of the Act establish the Minnesota Forest Resources Partnership, and this is a group that provides a forum for collaboration and coordination among our forest managers, landowners, and loggers to address landscape level concerns. It requires the development of the timber harvesting and forest management voluntary site level guidelines. These guidelines continue to provide our state foresters with sound, practical, best management practices that reflect the range of interests in our forests. These guidelines are important and they're used widely. They're a standard by which timber harvest is conducted in the state, and it's a big job to continuously monitor, research, and recommend changes to the guidelines based on better science. The Act also establishes the Research Advisory Committee, and this group provides collaboration among the forest research community to develop improvements to our knowledge of forest management and practical approaches such as improvements to the site-level guidelines. It creates the Interdisciplinary Information Cooperative, and that's for the purpose of coordinating, developing, and sharing forest resource data across private and public organizations and institutions. And lastly, it encourages continuing education, specifically the Minnesota Logger Education Program and the University of Minnesota Sustainable Forest Education Cooperative. These are just a few examples of the benefits of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act to provide better overall management of our forests in our state. And having an expiration date for this section of law allows us to reassess the Act every few years, determine if and where we need changes, and it offers an opportunity to have a conversation about the policies in the section. We recommend extending the sunset date in this section of the statute, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer questions if time allows.
Thank you, Mr. Tilma. Representative Heinzman, I see your hand. We have 2 more testifiers, and then we'll get to member questions. I have
just
Bob.
Line, Madam Chair.
Okay, sure. All right, next up I have Bob Graves. Mr. Graves, if you can introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Chair, Representative Lippert, committee members, my name is Bob Graves, a volunteer member of the Sierra Club's North Star chapter, representing 80,000 members and supporters. After working 41 years in industry as a chemical engineer, I'm retired and now chair the Forests and Wildlife Stewards within the Sierra Club. We appreciate the opportunity to testify and strongly endorse HF 214. 214 would make a notable effect on addressing the rise of climate change using natural solutions in reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by managing forest lands for carbon sequestration. These natural practices would sequester some 13 million metric tons of CO2 per year, or the equivalent of taking three coal plants offline, according to information from the Nature Conservancy's report, Nature and Climate Solutions for Minnesota. These natural remedies have the bonus of trees helping save themselves. As a resident near the northern town of Ely, I've observed firsthand the decimation of firs and spruces from insect damage that's increased from a warming climate. Aside from the ecological hit of losing these boreal signature trees, this is detrimental to tourism, a key source of jobs in northern Minnesota. So while Minnesota's forests are harmed by the effects of climate change, let's utilize and encourage healthy and older trees, which naturally store carbon in biomass. The largest category of natural forest solutions is utilizing reforestation, replanting trees into forested lands, and afforestation, the conversion of abandoned and degraded agricultural or urban lands into forests. Since most of the reforestation opportunities are privately owned, we support incentive programs to private landowners. As for DNR administered lands, we have discussed with the DNR about climate change and carbon sequestration. So it's good to see that we're echoing some of the same thoughts that Mr. Tillman made just recently. Improving forest management, such as extending forest rotation ages to allow trees to mature longer, is another natural climate solution. Older age trees convert and sequester carbon at a higher rate than younger trees. Sierra Club has collegially interacted with the Minnesota Forest Resources Council on finding natural climate change solutions, and we submitted additional recommendations to their recent report on this topic. We fully support the tenets of HF 214 for adding carbon sequestration considerations into the statutes listed at 214. This is a win-win proposition that utilizes nature-based solutions to address climate change while improving the ecology and wildlife of forests in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And I do want to just note that Representative Keeler just joined us in the committee as well. Next up on the list, I have Pete Aub. Mr. Aub, I don't know if I'm saying your last name right, but if you can identify yourself for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Pete Aub, Chair of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the council. And thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing heightened attention to climate change and the sustainable forest management. In 1995, when the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, which we also refer to as 89A, was established, it provided comprehensive provisions to sustainably manage, use, and protect Minnesota forest resources, and it was groundbreaking. SFRA has proven the test of time, and the Act's provision and approach are as important, relevant, useful today as they were 25 years ago. The Council, with its 16 members representing broad stakeholder and constituency groups, have worked hard to be proactive on the most important forest issues, including climate change, which is the emphasis of this bill. We want you to know we work for you and the governor. We're at your service in any way we can. Last fall, we published a climate change report, Climate Change Minnesota Forest, a 75-page document. wherein we describe the changing climate as a major threat to our environment and sustainable forest management. Our forests cover over one third of the state and provide an extremely important ecosystem with services that provide habitat, wildlife habitat, and an economic engine from tourism and the forest products industry for both rural and tribal communities. In addition, as already indicated and discussed, forest lands play a significant role in sequestering and storing carbon, which will be an essential tool for building a smart climate strategy. Two main issues within forestry and climate change is highlighted as Representative Lippert's legislation is using forests for natural carbon storage and helping our forest transition to a climate-resilient species composition. Choosing appropriate tree species that are expected to thrive in emerging climate will be essential to helping our forests resist the impact of climate change and be resilient and possibly transition to novel compositions. Our climate change report provides insight into these adaptation strategies. In addition to research, however, the council is recommending at this time and ahead of the game, recommending and implementing science-based best management practice at the regional landscape level. This is across all ownerships, including DNR, county, private, tribal. And through this landscape program, which is chaired by Dr. Jim Manolis of the Nature Conservancy, the council is including a climate change section in its second generation plans, including the most recent East Central region, which will be completed this year. The East Central plan covers over 3.7 million acres over nine counties. And Section 8 in that plan includes 10 detailed forest-wide strategies for climate adaptation, and then cover type adaptation strategies for the five major cover types in that region. We will be amending plans in the other five regions to include the climate change section. You will also see other work related to climate change research, including some of the peat research that was already discussed that exists up in the impact of climate change at the Marcel Experiment Station. And we have integrated this information into our recently published biennial plan. And an even more robust emphasis on climate change in our latest strategic plan for the next 3 to 5 years. We want you to be assured that the council fully recognizes the unique role forests play against the threat of climate change and will leverage that role to the collective benefit of Minnesotans. We recognize that while our forests are adapting to climate change, they still provide an excellent opportunity to store incrementally more carbon naturally. Once again, Minnesota Forest Resource Climate Report provides key approaches to increasing carbon sequestration in our climate change era, including reforestation, modification to management practice, promoting the use of all wood products are all approaches that sequester and store carbon in forest and forest products. This report also offers recommendations for policy action and program adjustments. And I'm pleased that the legislature is furthering the work the council has laid out and will continue to in its responsibility to lead. To combat the forces of climate change, we need to be bold, strategic, and proactive in our policies and programs moving forward. And with the authorities granted to us by the Sustainable Forest Resource Act, the council is committed to help chart the course moving forward. So we very much appreciate your reauthorization of the Minnesota Forest Resources Act. And thank you, Chair and members of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, for allowing me to testify. I stand for question if time allows.
Thank you, Mr. Albee. I do, we are gonna move to member questions. I see Representative Heintzman has a question. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have several questions. Mostly, I think that the language here in the bill today, Representative Lippert, is things we can agree on, but I'm glad to see that Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer appears to be here, and I would have a couple of questions for Commissioner Meyer if he's available, but I also have some for Representative Lippert as well. The first question for DNR, you know, as we're looking at the language and listening to the discussion from the testifiers, it kind of leaves me feeling like there's a huge gaping hole at DNR as it pertains to carbon sequestration and reforestation. We've already heard a couple of bills from Representative Lippert on what we need to do to enhance nurseries and capacity, but is there a problem at DNR? Are we missing the boat when it comes to providing resources for reforestation, Commissioner?
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. You have two different questions here, I think, Representative Heinzman. The reforestation issue is one that we deal with every year. Unfortunately, the last bonding bill didn't contain any funds for reforestation, and it's very critical that before this session ends, we achieve some funding level for our reforestation needs to manage our healthy forests. The other part of the question that you were asking is, are we missing the boat on carbon sequestration? No, we take that issue very seriously as well. Working with the legislature and the governor's climate change committee, carbon sequestration is one of the easiest things we can do to help offset some of those issues. And the, pardon the pun, the low-hanging fruit of that equation is planting trees, right? So we need trees, and Representative Lippert's bills help accelerate those activities. We heard a bill previously that would provide money, and in the governor's budget, it's a similar proposal to accelerate planting and the growing of seedlings to then get into private landowners' hands to plant trees. So there's a ton of different ways to do it. I don't think we're missing the boat at all. The one opportunity we do need to address in the short term is our reforestation needs. But I think everybody recognizes that and wants to work on that as well. And then how do we accelerate those activities moving forward? And if, I don't know, Madam Chair, or Representative Heinzman, if that answers your question. If not, I would have Mr. Tilma talk about it more.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a follow-up. Thank you for that answer, Commissioner. That really does help. I guess I've been kind of feeling like DNR isn't doing everything it should be doing and that these bills are somehow fixing a problem at DNR. It sounds like we're accelerating as opposed to fixing a problem, and that makes more sense. Commissioner Meyer, if I could, just one more question along those lines. Reforestation is obviously a really important part of forest management, and we have an ongoing effort to make sure that our timber is available to the manufacturers of products that require timber. When we do have a large area cut now, clear cutting actually provides a really good opportunity to start over. And I'm just wanting to confirm, Bob, since we're talking about forests, could you, Commissioner Meyer, let me know, are we missing any opportunities as it relates to some of the reforestation effort that comes behind those logging operations at the state?
Commissioner Meyer?
Madam Chair, members, no, we work very closely with the forest industry to make sure that after a site is harvested, that it's regenerated as well. I think as we talked about, we're close to running out of reforestation funding to do that, to do those activities. So all the help, more help we can get, the better off we are. But we're working with, producers, we're working with private landowners to try to plant and get regenerated, as quickly as possible. A lot of those sites will naturally regenerate, but some of them don't, so they need help, which is our activities. And then some of them we need to transform to be more effective. Maybe it as we deal with the changing weather patterns and climate change, we see forest succession going on. So one site might not be the best for what was growing on there, and we need to reestablish what will succeed and is what fits into that local ecotype. So we look at these activities on several different levels, but the ultimate benefits are, not only carbon sequestration, but clean water, and there's recreational components to it too. So I hope that tries to answer your questions. Otherwise, Mr. Tilma could probably provide more information about if we are missing any opportunities or not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
That was really helpful. I appreciate the commissioner's input on that. I do have one final question or potentially line of question depending on the answer, but Representative Lippert, I see in the language there is specifically written into your bill a reference to trees that would be able to cope with changing climate. And I'm wondering if you could help me understand what tree species, in your opinion, fits that bill. What tree species are more adaptable to a changing climate?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heintzman. So I think there's a lot of research underway about exactly which species will fit the changing climate in Minnesota as the decades move forward. And so, you know, I think climate change is a significant enough challenge for us that it's important for us to be clear in statute that we want to be managing, forests to be managed related to carbon sequestration, also thinking about the ways that climate change is going to be changing our forests and how species are the best species that could adapt to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Lippert, I appreciate your attempt to answer that question, but I don't think that you're really super familiar with the tree species that are most resistant to climate change around the state of Minnesota. And that's part of the reason I asked the question. These are important issues, and I hope that as you're bringing a number of these bills, you'd look at that research firsthand and have that knowledge to really work with the folks at DNR and other agencies that are trying to improve the forestry options around the state of Minnesota. And Representative Lippert, I've been working in this world for my entire life. You know, a lot of teams, when people come to an oak forest, they see oak trees, but really there's 26 varieties of oak trees just here, red oak trees in my part of the state. I've spent time planting thousands and thousands and thousands of seedlings myself, and I hope that I can work with you on a number of these issues because it's really super important, and I do appreciate the effort. I do hope that there can be some more collaboration around this particular type of, or this particular subject.
All right.
Madam Chair, Representative Heisman, I would look forward to having more conversations with you going forward. I recognize the importance of reforestation. I also understand the complexity of forest ecosystems and the ways that climate change is going to make that even more complex and sustaining our forests even more complex going forward. And we'll trust the experts on how to move us forward with climate and forestry from here.
All right, members, any other questions? Not seeing any hands going up. Representative Lippert, if you have any closing remarks.
I thank the committee for its time today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lippert renews his motion that House File 214 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Eklund to chair, as I have a couple of bills up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wazowick, I got your name wrong right off the bat. I apologize. Would you like to move that House File 248 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Representative Wazowick, I believe you have an author's amendment. Please briefly explain your author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the amendment essentially takes what was sort of a very broad requirement that the MPCA hold a public meeting when there is before an agreement is signed with a facility, and it narrows that bill a little bit. So it would only apply to cases where the agency is seeking a settlement of $25,000 or more. And then the amendment also details what the things, some of the things that should happen at that meeting. So the description of sort of the nature of the pollution, and then opportunities for public input. So that's what the amendment does.
Any questions, members, on the amendment? Representative Wazowick moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Wazowick to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as committee members probably recognize, we've heard quite a bit about water gremlin, especially in light of the OLA report that was released earlier this year. The report laid out mistakes and failures by the agency and offered recommendations for things the agency could do to improve oversight moving forward so that something like this doesn't happen again. In the wake of all of the concerns with water gremlin in 2019, one of the major concerns that I heard from constituents was that the stipulation agreement that was signed by the agency and the company was agreed to very quickly and that there was no community input involved in that process. The stipulation agreement included a supplemental environmental project, which required water gremlin to plant 1,500 trees in the affected communities. While it's certainly not a bad thing, as we just heard, planting trees is important, but it didn't really do anything to address the real concerns that community members had about the health impacts of almost two decades of exposure to high levels of TCE. And frankly, it seemed more like a PR move from a company who was trying to improve its public image than something that would actually have a substantial impact on the community. Based on the concerns expressed by my constituents, I introduced House File 248. As I described, the bill as amended would require the MPCA to hold a public meeting before finalizing a stipulation agreement or a consent decree with a facility that in which they were seeking a settlement of $25,000 or greater. The bill language says that the meetings should have provide a description of the amount, frequency, duration, and chemical nature of the pollution so that folks in the community who have been impacted know sort of what's happened in their community, what they've been exposed to, and then also allow for members of the public, including folks who have been potentially exposed to the pollution, to make the agency aware of interactions between the facility and the public regarding the facility's operations, operational problems or incidents that have occurred at the facility, and suggestions regarding those supplemental environmental projects that the public may prefer as part of a stipulation agreement or consent decree between the facility and the agency. So this bill is largely an attempt to try and put more public engagement into the process so that the folks who have been directly impacted by the pollution and the actions of the facility and the company have more of a say in that process. And with that, I know we have a couple of testifiers, so I will turn it over to them.
Thank you, Representative Wozlewick. First testifier, Sherry Smith, Neighborhood Concerned Citizens Group. Ms. Smith, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sherry Smith. I'm a resident of the White Bear Lake area and one of the founders of NCCG, or the Neighborhood Concerned Citizens Group. Our group formed shortly after we learned about significant toxic pollution that had occurred in our community for more than 17 years. And some recent reports indicate the length of time that our community was polluted is actually closer to 26 years. So this is important to note. The water gremlin situation, unfortunately, has come to define my life for the last 2 years. So much went wrong in our community with the water gremlin situation, and so much went wrong in how that situation was monitored and regulated by the MPCA, all right? That's why I'm here today, speaking in support of House File 248. And later, House File 1037, I don't want another water gremlin happening in any other community in the state of Minnesota. Again, that's important enough that I want to repeat it. I don't want another water gremlin situation happening anywhere in the state of Minnesota in the future. So once the MPCA was aware of the pollution that had tainted the air, the water, and the soil in our area, there was what has been repeatedly described as a rush to judgment, all right? A rush to judgment with MPCA quickly finalizing a stipulation agreement between Water Gremlin and the MPCA. The stipulation agreement was signed just weeks after the citizens were notified about this significant pollution that had occurred in our community. Unfortunately, the agreement was put in place without any community input. So House File 248 will require MPCA to hold a public meeting before finalizing agreements with certain facilities. This important requirement would give community members who've been directly impacted by the pollution a say in the process, all right? and in any potential community projects done by the community. This was the largest fine ever levied, or the second largest fine ever levied on a business by the MPCA. And of that fine, $4.5 million went into, went to a specific cause and reason. The rest of it was supplemental environmental projects, and in our community should have had some say so in what defined those supplemental environmental projects. We feel really strongly about that. And I am speaking not only on myself or for myself as a citizen, I am speaking on behalf of community members in both White Bear Lake, Gem Lake, and White Bear Township. All right, so House File 248 will require MPCA to hold a public meeting before finalizing any agreement. This is a really important requirement. Our community was stunned by the news about Water Gremlin. We felt powerless and frankly scared about what it meant for ourselves, our families, and our health. And we would have appreciated the opportunity to provide our perspective and opinions about how to hold this company accountable for the damage they did to our community before final settlements were reached. And I thank you for hearing my comments on House File 248.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Please stick around in case there's any questions. Next up is Tony Quillis, from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Quillis, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for allowing me just a couple of moments to make some comments on House File 248. Mr. Chairman, members, consent decrees and stipulation agreements are negotiated settlements between entities and state agencies. They have many legal representatives in these negotiated settlements, and sometimes they take days, weeks, or months to reach a final agreement. And it results in significant time and cost for the entity involved, as well as for the state agency. Mr. Chairman, the bill itself says before finalizing a consent agreement or a stipulation agreement that a public information hearing must be held. And Representative Wasilek detailed out of what that would look like, including suggestions on a supplemental environmental project. The question, Mr. Chairman, that I have, and it's kind of unclear, and the bill itself doesn't specify, is after the public meeting and taking the suggestions on the supplemental environmental project, if there is one, does that require the entities and the state agency to go back and open negotiations again and then try and implement those public comments? And so I'm just trying to figure out, Mr. Chairman, would it set up a never-ending loop of a negotiated settlement, a public hearing, the input, asking the entities and the state agencies to go back, take that public input, incorporate it, then go back for another public meeting, and just worried, Mr. Chairman, that it kind of sets up that never-ending loop, adding time and cost to both the entities as well as the state agency. So just, I was unclear in, you know, the bill itself doesn't specify on how that process would work. And I think in the end, it might end up just sending more cases to court. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. I appreciate you allowing me to comment on House File 248. And I'll stick around for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chair, can I just address some of those things that Mr. Quillis brought up?
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the comments, Mr. Quillis. So the goal is really here to have the public meeting before the negotiations are completed so that there's some opportunity for the public to have their voice heard and then have that considered. There's no requirement that the agency or the company has to say, yes, we're doing that thing. We really want the community to have a say, to have a voice in this process, and to say, here's how we've been impacted. Here's what we would like to see, in this agreement that we think would be beneficial to the community, those of us who have been directly impacted. And so if the agency and the company can't agree on a thing that's been proposed, that's not The concern is more that no one, that their voices have not been heard in the process at all. And to be told that we polluted your community with cancer-causing chemicals for 26 years and here are 1,500 trees is not an acceptable response to what happened with Water Gremlin. So that's the goal of this, is to really include more public engagement in that process and to try and get a better outcome for the community that the community accepts and you know, frankly, is okay with in some way. So that's sort of, that's the process there. And if we need to clarify that in some way, that it's where in the timeline that happens, we can certainly have that ongoing conversation.
Thank you, Representative Wasowick. Next up is, excuse me, Greta Gauthier from Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Ms. Gauthier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify on House File 248. Mr. Chairman, I'm having a problem. There we go. Mr. Chair, MPCA shares the goal of public engagement and transparency in our work. Negotiated settlements, whether they are stipulation agreements or consent decrees, they are an enforcement tool that we frequently use. They allow us to move more quickly in implementing the enforcement and addressing the impacts of any violations more quickly than if we were to try to settle these violations in court. The MPCA averages about 25 to 30 negotiated settlements in a fiscal year. One of our biggest concerns with this bill as it was introduced was the potential conflict with the data practices requirements. Currently, those requirements prohibit us from disclosing to the public the details of an enforcement until that enforcement process is concluded, but the language in the DE amendment did address this issue. Mr. Chair, we appreciate that the language as amended scopes the bill from the original language. The information to be disclosed at the public meeting is more focused. The $25,000 bar also scopes the bill somewhat. We are interested in exploring whether that bar is intended to focus on the largest violations with the largest impacts. We have many negotiated settlements that are settled for less than $25,000. We appreciate the definition of supplemental environmental project. Also, we do have a few suggestions for tweaks to that language as well. We continue to work through the language as amended to ensure that we could implement this bill smoothly and efficiently. And we will continue, we would like to continue working with the chair to achieve our shared goals. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. And with the neck of the woods that I'm from, sometimes you automatically put that French accent on the end of a name when I see it. So,
Mr. Chair, I will answer to both.
Anyway, that's it for testifiers. Representative Wasowick, so we'll go to members' questions. First up is Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to ask some questions. I want to say thank you to Representative Wasowick for bringing this bill forward. This is something that's really important to make sure that community voices are engaged and people are heard in the process so that we don't miss anything. And most importantly to Ms. Smith for all the work and time that she and her group has put in to help make sure that this doesn't happen to anybody else. And when there are violations in the future, there's a way to protect the public and engage the public. My question is for Mr. Quillis. When he was talking about the public meeting for the to be able to get information from the community that's been impacted. And I'm wondering for Mr. Quillis if he'd be able to suggest what might be a better point in the process or for this public meeting to happen, because it sounds like it's important to have this public meeting. And I'd like to be, I'm curious to know from the business perspective, what would be the best time to have that before the stipulation agreement is signed.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that's a good question. And that's why I was just asking for right now, as Representative Wasowick pointed out, to me, when I look at this, I'm not sure. It just says before finalizing. So I'm not sure if because it doesn't happen right now, where in the process that would work. But the way I interpret it right now is, you reach an agreement and a negotiated settlement, then you have to come out for the public meeting. I think you and Representative Wasilek are saying if there's a violation, there should be a public meeting. And I'm not sure where in that process we would go through that. Like I said, to this point, you've got to get to a stipulation or a consent agreement. So sometimes those are private negotiations, as Ms. Gauthier pointed out. And so where that public meeting, I think, is a good question of how it would work in those private negotiation settlements.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. I understand that it's always tough in the details, but it also sounds like it's very important that we have this public meeting to occur so that we can make sure that the needs of the community are not being left behind. So it sounds like it might be something that could possibly be earlier. I appreciate you giving a little bit more detail on it because it's important that we allow this the public to become engaged and to make sure that their concerns are addressed. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to jump in and say that there actually was a public meeting before the stipulation agreement was finalized with Water Gremlin to let people know about what happened, but there was no attempt to take any sort of public feedback about what was happening in that stipulation agreement. So it is possible, even in a very short timeline, to have a meeting, to get a meeting organized, including in the middle of winter. This was a meeting that was held in February of 2019. It is possible to get a meeting set up in a short timeline and be able to get that feedback from the community to the agency to take with them into negotiations. So just wanted to point that out, that in the Water Gremlin case, we had this meeting, but there was not an opportunity for the public to sort of weigh in on sort of here's what the company did. What does the community have to say about that? And certainly there was the opportunity for the community to have some conversation, but it was largely focused around specifics about what happened with Water Gremlin and the chemicals and not about what the community wanted to see as outcomes from those solutions.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions for the commissioner and then also for the bill author. Commissioner, as you were talking a few minutes ago about some of the challenges that the agency faces during negotiations and what can and can't be shared, a question that I was wondering, I'm not trying to think of how to phrase this so that it's to make the most sense, but a question that came to me was, is there something missing in the process, a tool that you need to get better outcomes for the public when there is a violation, what we've seen at Water Gremlin? And I think the bill author, and this is why I mentioned I have a couple of questions for the bill author also, I think the bill author is trying to get at resolving these issues with some more public input. Is there another way to do that, or is that process already available in a form that maybe the bill author isn't aware of? And did MPCA ask for this? Is this something that you're pushing for? So there's a couple of different questions there, but you know, you can take a shot at whatever feels like it would be the most helpful to the committee.
We'll go with Ms. Gauthier first, and then Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the question, Representative Heintzman. So I'll try to hit all three of your questions. So first of all, under the current way that the data practices is set up, we can hold a public meeting for three reasons. One is to quell public unrest. One is to protect public health from imminent threat. And the third is to aid in the law enforcement process. So dispelling widespread rumor, imminent public health, and law enforcement process. So in the case of Water Gremlin, we felt that there was widespread unrest about this. And so we did hold a public meeting before we had a negotiated settlement. We did achieve a negotiated settlement shortly thereafter, a few weeks later, and then we started implementing it. So that's the answer to one of your questions. A second question is that it's hard to say. I mean, we want to be engaged with the public. and we have been, around both the Northern Meadows and Water Gremlin, which are two of the biggest enforcements we've had recently. I think it's difficult, and I know this is going to sound, I think it's difficult because every enforcement is different, right? So, for example, at Water Gremlin, we had a negotiated settlement pretty quickly on the air violations because we wanted to move quickly to get the mitigation in place, to get their new equipment up, and to make sure that the community's concerns about this were addressed. But since then, in the fall of that year, there were other violations at this site related to hazardous waste. And as Mr. Quilla said, we're still in the process of a negotiated settlement on those violations here. So it's, do we need more tools? I think we are always open to new ways that we can get public engagement. And so I think that we're open to discussing this bill with the author, because we have heard loud and clear from people in these communities that they want more involvement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up to that. Commissioner, I think that just judging by the number of bills that we've seen from the bill author, that the issue really is localized to, at least it appears to be, a number of bad actors. Is there a way that we could get at some of those concerns without impacting? I think you had mentioned earlier, somebody did, there's 25 actions per year that potentially could be affected. Is there a way that we could get at this issue without having such a significant statewide, or at least potentially significant statewide impact? So it sounds, maybe the amendment dealt with that to some extent, but it does feel a little bit like this particular scenario is going to have impacts all around the state potentially. And that may be good, that may not, but I'm wondering, you know, maybe there's a way in your mind, I'm not sure if you've thought through this, but you know, are there other ways that we could maybe get at the heart of the concern and the problem as it's being explained relative to the Water Gremlin case or Twin Metals?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Heintzman, thank you for that question. I agree with you, Representative Heintzman, the amendment did scope this down. So I don't know that the number of negotiated settlements that this would apply to is still 25 to 30. It might be different because of that $25,000 cap. One way we could further scope it would be to increase that cap somewhat, so that it doesn't capture some of the smaller enforcements where, you know, there is not maybe the extensive issues like we have seen at Water Gremlin, for example. So that might be one, that would be one pathway that we would be interested in discussing. We need to pull together more data on those for the last few years, what those enforcement amounts have been, and take a look at that and be happy to do that. So I think we are scoping it down already, and we're happy to work more with the author if she's open to that.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That actually answered a lot of my questions. So, you know, mostly just a comment, and maybe Representative Wozlik would like to respond. That would be fine if there's something that you would like to add. But, you know, when we have examples of pollutants being expelled at rates significantly higher than permitted, and we have bad actors out there, I think we all agree that we need to have the tools to stop that and to penalize those folks that are deliberately polluting and potentially causing harm to human health because of the excessive actions that they have taken in the handling of these materials that are dangerous. I just hope that as we're trying to approach this issue in a way that would, I'm assuming, be preventative in future cases, that we're talking to everybody involved. It doesn't sound like MPCA was invited into the discussions around what would be the best way to try to engage the public. Maybe that happened, and I'm assuming incorrectly. But I hope that in a spirit of just trying to get at the heart of the issue, as opposed to just writing a bill, which that may not be the case, but I do hope that we would try to have the right approach, because there are great companies around Minnesota that are absolutely committed to doing the right thing. And I don't want them to get caught up in some kind of difficulty that ties up MPCA FTEs and all kinds of different hoops that they have to jump through when they're, like I said, committed to doing the right thing. So hopefully we can continue to look at the scope of these kinds of ideas and make sure that we're really getting at the issue. And Representative Wasilick, if you want to, like I said, add something to that, I'd appreciate it if there's something that maybe could shed some light on this. I know it's being laid over and we're having more of a conversation, so that's part of the reason I'm having the
discussions.
Representative Wasilick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple of things. So the bill really originated from the concerns that I heard from constituents about the lack of public engagement in that process, where the company came to a pretty quick agreement with the MPCA on the stipulation agreement. So that's where the bill originated from. I've had ongoing conversations with the agency since this bill was first introduced about how can we sort of address these issues. If it's not this way, what do we do? And those conversations will continue. I did want to shed some light on we worked on an almost identical amendment last year. I think there was one word difference. And I had done some research and looked at all of the publicly available information, public data on enforcement penalties. And I was thinking about an amount, and we had said maybe 25,000 or 50,000. And at that time, with those two numbers in mind, that would have resulted in between 1 to 15 meetings per year based on the publicly available data on enforcement penalties from the last 10 years. So I did go through and look at that and try to use that as a guide for figuring out, you know, we don't want to have this be a burden on the agency to have to do this many meetings. And so if there's a threshold we can set that we think works, then we settle on the $25,000, but certainly open to conversation about whether that's the right level or whether that there's another number we could use for that. So that's sort of insights from what I had, the digging I had done on that issue, and I'll leave it at that unless there are other questions.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the questions I still have are applicable looking at the next bill, so I'll probably hold those for that next conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Closing comments, Representative Wasilick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for discussion today, and thank you to Sherry Smith with the neighborhood group for being here. I know her and our fellow community members have been really negatively impacted by this and want to have an opportunity to express, for community members to express what these violations mean to the community, and how perhaps there can be discussion about how a company can be held accountable, but also be doing things that are in line with what the community wants to have happen. So thank you for the opportunity to present the bill.
Representative Wasilick renews her motion that House File 248, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. The next item on the agenda is House File 1037. Representative Wasilick, would you like to move that House File 1037 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, that is my motion.
Representative Wasilick, I believe you have an author's amendment. Would you please briefly describe your author's amendment?
Yep, so the author's amendment, similar to the author's amendment from the last bill we just discussed, scopes the bill to make it more narrow, so it doesn't apply to as many facilities as it would have before. And what it does is it adds a definition of, see the wording here, of priority facility. And so that definition would be in there, and then the all of the adjustments would be made to make this bill really apply to those facilities that are described as priority facilities in the bill language. It also adds a requirement to require a report from the agency about that work. And there are some details on what's required in that report in there as well. And that's the gist of the amendment.
Members, any questions on the author's amendment? Representative Wozlik moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Amendment is adopted. Representative Wozlik to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the basic goal of House File 1037 is to really make sure that what facilities are emitting, the things that they're claiming they're emitting are actually what they're physically emitting. And so House File 1037 sort of requires an extra step in the process to ensure compliance with air emission limits. The main piece of the bill that's here is really that the A1 amendment addresses is to scope the bill to the 15 facilities issued air quality permits that pose the greatest risk to human health and environment. And so the permits that would be issued to these facilities must have some sort of protocol in place to measure the pollutants that are being issued by the facility. And there's a sort of a list of methods in the language that folks can look at, but just a variety of methods that facilities can use to actually measure the physical, to physically measure the what's coming out of their facility. And then this would also require that they report emission measurements to the MPCA on a monthly basis. And then there are requirements for how often facilities would have to conduct performance tests based on certain criteria that are listed in the bill. And then the addition of the reporting requirement that would require the MPCA to submit annual reports of actions taken to comply with this statute beginning February 15th, 2022. So that's sort of the gist of the bill, and I will turn it over to testifiers at this point.
Thank you, Representative Wozlik, and I apologize. I thought I muted myself when I sneezed, but I found out I didn't. Testifiers, Sherry Smith, Neighborhood Concerned Citizens Group. Ms. Smith, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. As I said earlier, my name is Sherry Smith. I'm a resident of the White Bear Lake area and one of the founders of the NCCG, or the Neighborhood Concerned Citizens Group. A report released less than a month ago by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the OLA, recognized the profound failings in how the water gremlin matter was handled. And it was labeled, frankly, a case study in what can go wrong. So today, we are continuing to work and we are working actively to put course corrections in place so that another community one will not be labeled a case study in what can go wrong. House File 1037 is one step that we can take to do just that. It will require more frequent physical measurements of emissions, all right, for certain facilities, not all facilities, for certain facilities, so that we can hopefully catch something bad before it goes on for almost two decades like it did in my community. As a private citizen who has been so negatively impacted by the water gremlin scenario, and as a citizen who represents others in my community, I ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Next up is Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Quillis, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and thank you for allowing me to make a couple of comments on the mechanics and implementation of House File 1037. Mr. Chairman, we were thankful to see the A1 amendment because as the bill was drafted and introduced, it would have affected every single air permit in the state of Minnesota, numbering over 3,000, somewhere between 3,000 and probably 5,000 air permits in the state of Minnesota. With the A1 amendment, we're now talking about priority facilities. They're going to be about 15 of them. But still, within that definition, Mr. Chairman, it identifies those priority facilities either using MinRisk or another model employed by the agency with volume and toxicity of their emissions or threat to human health and environment. And depending on how you apply those definitions, that changes who those 15 facilities would be. So it's just not clear in those definitions in the criteria who those 15 facilities would be, Mr. Chairman. It is my belief also that of those 15 facilities, they're probably already required to test by the EPA, have compliance assurance components that specify testing, monitoring, and reporting of all their equipment in all their facilities. Mr. Chairman, another just question on the mechanics and implementation. For all of the air permits that would be required under the priority facilities, some of these facilities might have multiple emission points. So would it require then for every multiple emission point, for every one of those, for every single pollutant to be monitored and reported on a monthly basis? And the question there is, it's going to result, it's not going to be a little bit of paper. It's going to be a significant amount of paper submitted to the Pollution Control Agency, which I think will be challenging for them to process. Mr. Chairman, also on the bill, it talks about any significant alteration, repair, or replacement. There have been decades of litigation and debate over what a modification or an alteration is, and we're worried that this might lead to increased litigation and also sets up a conflict. What if a facility was going to reduce? Would this also then require the performance test within 90 days? So just some questions, Mr. Chairman, along those lines. To go back to what the priority facility definition includes, MNRISC was set up on to do a community scale risk. It wasn't set up to do individual facilities. And along those lines, when we talk about another model that's going to qualify these priority facilities, if an individual facility did their own specific risk assessment, could that be used in that priority facility definition? And just a question that it had come up, Mr. Chairman, so I just wanted to put that out there. If a facility did do their own specific risk assessment, could that be included? And just one hypothetical, Mr. Chairman, on the implementation again and the mechanics of this. If in one of these priority facilities had a permit, and it included an emergency backup generator in the permit, which is regulated under federal and state rules and is referenced in the permit. That backup generator doesn't have to be turned on at all unless it's an emergency and needs to be turned back on. So if there's monthly reporting required in the permit of these facilities, would that backup generator have to be turned on monthly for the report to go in there? So just some of the questions, Mr. Chairman, that we've had as we're looking at the mechanics and implementation of this. Thank you for the time. Appreciate to make the comments on House File 1037.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Next up is Assistant Commissioner Greta Gauthier from the MPCA. Commissioner Gauthier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today on House File 1037 as amended. Mr. Chairman, the MPCA works to protect our air by monitoring pollutants, assisting with compliance to and enforcing laws to maintain air quality, and issuing permits to facilities to control air pollution. Mr. Chair, all of our air quality work is aimed at the goal of clean air for all Minnesotans. Air permits from the MPCA are intended to minimize the impact from emissions coming from regulated facilities. Mr. Chair, we have met with the author on this bill, and we thank her for today's A1 amendment that significantly narrows the scope of this bill from the language as introduced. House File 1037, as amended, does establish new regulations of air emissions from just a subset of the roughly 2,000 permitted facilities with air permits in Minnesota, and specifically to facilities that we prioritize using our MNRISC's modeling or another form of modeling. And just for the record, Mr. Chair, MNRISC's is a risk screening tool that we've developed that helps us predict impacts of air pollution and helps us prioritize our work. We are working right now to populate such a list as what is required by the bill as amended we will probably need more time in producing that list because we want to make sure it's based on the best available data. Mr. Chair, we'd like to continue working with the author on this bill to achieve our shared objectives of clean air for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Gauthier. Member questions. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Gauthier, you said just a moment ago that you're working to populate that list, and I can't help but wonder which companies you've already identified or locations you've already identified that would fit the criteria as laid out in the amendment, because of course we're all scratching our heads. We have no idea, and it would be helpful to know what we're talking about in terms of the criteria and how it would apply. So who do we know that it would affect thus far?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Heintzman, thank you for that question. It's complicated, Representative Heintzman, by the fact that, you know, as you know, under federal law, speaking broadly now, under federal law, there's a framework of voluntary self-reporting for some air permits and some regulated contaminants or emissions. So MnRisks is a prediction tool, and so we use both modeling and data. We have voluntary self-reporting of this type of data every 3 years. We just got a new round of data in at the end of 2020. Prior to that, it was 2017. And so we're trying to assimilate that new data that we have. Also, facilities are not required to report that data, so in some cases, we don't have it. So we're trying to estimate how we could implement this language, and we're in the process of trying to figure that out. So until we do that, I don't really know that we could pull up a list that we feel has solid enough underpinning statistically and data-wise that we feel comfortable releasing that. And again, it's based on the playing field that we all have, which is the federal construct of we set these facilities up with a permit and then rely on voluntary self-reporting.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is a really strange bill, Representative Wasilewicz, because you're driving at, I think, an outcome that you want to see. But at the same time, we don't know who's going to be affected by this language. I'm trying not to be obnoxious about it, but I guess it'd be better just to be blunt. Are you specifically targeting specific businesses that you feel are emitting, or that you are? What is the reasoning behind the criteria in the amendment? And if you have specific businesses that you want to be affected, why not just lay that out in the bill so we know who is?
Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heintzman, I'm not trying to target specific businesses. I don't have a list in my back pocket of, like, this business one time shorted me 10 cents on this, so I'm going to attack them with this new regulation. The goal, if you read the definition of priority facility that's in the amendment, it's based on the language pose the greatest risks to human health and the environment in Minnesota. And so what we're trying to do is to really make sure that we are actually doing what, you know, the mission of the MPCA is to protect and improve the environment and human health. And if we have these facilities that we know pose these great risks to human health and the environment in the state, we want to make sure that the amount of emissions and things that they're putting out there, that we actually know what's going on with that. We've seen cases, Water Gremlin was one case, Northern Metals was another, where we didn't have an accurate idea of what was physically being emitted by facilities. And some of that was based on, in Northern Metals' case, on them intentionally fudging numbers. And in Water Gremlin's case, a whole lot of other issues involved with that. So this is sort of what we're trying to get at, is we want to make sure that these facilities that pose the greatest risk to health and human health and the environment in our state are actually emitting what they say they're emitting, to make sure that those companies are following the rules and make sure that we're not posing greater risk than we need to human health and the environment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
I guess my response to that, Representative, would be if Northern Metals and Water Gremlin were not affected by your bill, are you just going to be coming back to this committee with another bill? Because if that's who you're wanting to affect, and you don't get what you want under the criteria that you have in the language here, it just seems like we're spinning our wheels a little bit. And as I'm listening to the commissioner explain the complexity of what you're doing, it seems a little odd. And I'm wondering if there might be a better way to get the result that you want.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Heintzman. As I've already said, this isn't targeted at certain specific companies. I'm just giving those examples as examples of companies that said they were emitting something and it turned out they weren't. And this is another way to double check and make sure that what companies are telling us they're emitting is actually what they're emitting. So that's the goal, is to be able to physically measure that and actually know what's coming out of these facilities. And by sort of scoping it to these priority facilities, these are the ones, as I said, that pose the greatest risk to human health and environment. We want to make sure that, knowing that, that they aren't putting more toxic chemicals out into the environment than they should be. So that's the goal. Again, not directed towards any other companies. Water Gremlin and Northern Metals have both had significant settlements and lots of other processes that they've followed. And that's part of how this works. It's not targeting them. This is an effort to try and ensure, again, that we're protecting and improving the environment and human health in our state.
Mr. Chair.
Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you're hearing some of the same things I am, and I am curious, finally, this would be my last question. I understand that the representative isn't specifically stating who is or isn't targeted by this language, but as you suggested earlier, this is complicated. We already have a backlog of permits that are waiting for approval, and it's a huge job at MPCA to do this, and it's obviously been more and more difficult as time goes on with the complexities that you already mentioned. If this bill becomes law, do we have any idea how this might affect timelines for Minnesota businesses trying to get permits in the subject areas affected by the language?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. I do not know the answer to that question, Representative Heintzman, but I will say that I know the committee will, in the near future, be looking at the governor's budget recommendations, and we have recommended 3 more FTEs for our AIR program to focus on some of this compliance assistance work so that we can be more responsive to communities. So it is a shared goal, but we also want to enhance our compliance assistance. And also that will help, if we get these additional people, will help our permit writers be able to focus solely on permit writing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Just a comment. Considering that we already have a backlog of air permits, we're hearing that there's 3 potential hires that could affect the current backlog. We have no idea how this bill will impact or increase that workload at MPCA and how it would even affect the overall quality of work needed to get through the permitting process for these businesses. I have to say that I have more questions than I had at the beginning of the conversation, but I will go ahead and I see we have others that want to ask a few of their own. I will move on.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say that I don't get the impression at all that this bill is about what Representative Wasilek wants, but about protecting Minnesotans from the most toxic pollutants. And I think, if anyone watching this is puzzled, I mean, part of the backstory on this is that Representative Wasilewicz and others have been working on bills that were more expansive and were told that it was, too expansive. Let's try to narrow it down to the things that are the most dangerous. That's exactly what's being done here. It's targeting the things that are most likely to harm people. And, I'm puzzled about, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to just let businesses poison our constituents because it would take some extra work to make sure that we're monitoring these things? You know, I really take seriously that my job is to be here for the people who I represent and the people of Minnesota. And I am really glad that Representative Wasilewicz has brought this forward. I think it's very reasonable. It is targeted at the things that are most likely to hurt people and to harm their health. And I think that's exactly what the MPCA should be doing and what we all should be doing as legislators. So, it's really frustrating when you hear from these constituents about how this has impacted them, and people for their entire lives are going to be impacted by businesses who put these pollutants into our air. And, I get the impression that some folks are not going to be happy with anything that Representative Wasilewicz tries to do or any of us try to do that puts any extra onus on businesses. And I think, our number one goal here is to work for the people and to keep people safe. And so I thank Representative Wasilewicz for bringing this bill forward.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, I have two questions. Thank you. This is maybe to the author or commissioner. What I'm not understanding is this not what MPCA is supposed to do already? Look for this. This bill seems to be a duplicate of already the responsibility of MPCA. I don't understand the difference. If you could help me out with that.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question, Representative Backer. So I think that people think that we do a lot more of this than is the case given the system that's set up by federal law. So we have to, of course, follow federal law, and the MPCA is delegated in Minnesota to do that and implement that. The Clean Air Act was written in the 70s, hasn't been updated since the 90s. The Clean Air Act basically says, when a facility starts up, we get a system in place where they have adequate filtration or whatever other equipment they need to reduce pollution coming out of their stack so that it is at a level that does not pose a threat in the greater air out there, right? Once we get that system in place under the federal construct, we rely on self-reporting. So we get the system in place, and then they are supposed to let us know if something is different. Do we inspect and do we watch them? Yes, but they are supposed to let us know. And in some cases that we have recently been talking about, that did not happen. We have made a lot of changes since Water Gremlin 2 years ago came up to make sure internally that we help guard against this ever happening again. And I'd be happy to go into those at some point. But I will say now that we're operating under the system that the federal government has set up, Ms. Representative Backer. Can a state be more protective than the federal government? Always. That is the option of the state. But the state can never be less protective than the government, the federal government. And so we're open to being more protective. We started a discussion last year with facilities in a webinar last summer around, how would it be if we had more mandatory reporting for some of these emissions? And so that conversation continues, and we're looking at issues that they brought up. But at this point in time, that, like I said, we want to work with Representative Wasilewicz on these and other bills that are designed to be more responsive to the community, to provide more information, and to have us do our job in a way that the legislature wants to be more protective of public health.
Representative Backer.
One more question. Thank you. So this is kind of a two-tier question. You know, we hear, and this is my concern, we have a lot of generalities in this bill and in certain things. So I want to know who this bill would affect and how Minnesota would be, you know, who would aid in the selection of those facilities. You know, I hear also there's rules that will be provided, so we know these facilities at our greatest risk, but, you know, who would be affected and how? That's my question. I don't know if that's the author or just a lot of generalities, and it concerns me. Words have meaning around here, and bills can affect people's livelihoods, both positive and negative. So who would this bill affect and how?
Representative Wasowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm having a hard time understanding the entirety of your question, Representative Backer. If you mean which facilities, in the bill it says 15 priority facilities. So those 15 priority facilities would be the ones that would be required to follow these new procedures and have these pieces as part of the implementation with MPCA. So, you know, you're saying that words have meaning, and 15 means exactly what it says. It means 15. Yeah, but we're not trying to pull a bag over on anyone, or I don't know if that's the right term, but that's exactly what we're trying to do, is those facilities that we know are pose the greatest risk to health, human health, and the environment. And in terms of who it would impact, I mean, I think if the communities around those facilities, the people across the state, if they have a better understanding of what facilities are actually emitting into their communities, they're able to understand that, and they're able to decide for themselves, you know, is this a concern? Should we be concerned that this facility right next to my house is putting out greater amounts of this toxic chemical than what they should be? So I think, I'm not sure if that answers the question of who. I'm not sure if you were going at the facilities themselves or broader people, but hopefully that provides some clarification.
Members, before we go on, Representative Backer, I'll call on you, but we're at the time in these meetings that we're down to 3 minutes. We have a 2:30 sharp stop, so we will be laying this.
I'll make a quick comment, and I appreciate the answer, but it still doesn't address the how. How do we determine those 14? I'm a chemist. You have to have rules. You can't just say, well, these are the 15th greatest. So that's my concern, is defining and making how we determine it. So with the time constraint, I will rest my other questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Fisher, quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to let people know that we're being offered a false choice. It sounds like we either fund getting business permits or fund protecting the environment. And when we take a look at the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, it gives the impression is we can do both. We should be funding both testing, the most polluting chemical agencies, companies, and at the same time providing the permit, the folks needed to do the permits out there. We need to have both together. We can do it if we have the will to fund it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to make one comment, and that is I've lived by Sherco 1 and 2 for about 40-some years. Drive by it all the time. And when we were talking about, at first, some of these pollution issues, I was hearing statements that said that people were driving down the freeway and they had mercury dripping out of these black clouds. Never. I've never seen black clouds come out of there. So I'm very cautious about listening to these things when I'm not hearing definites. And I just hope that we have those definites as this gets laid over, because we want facts, and I'm not hearing them. And it's not that I'm saying, hey, you're wrong. What I'm saying is that I've heard some testimony from some folks that was absolutely false. And so I want to make sure that when we look at a bill like this, we make sure that we have definite facts. Thank you.
Representative Morrison, we have about 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This whole conversation to me makes the case for increasing the budget of the MPCA. I certainly wouldn't want us to sacrifice the health and safety of Minnesotans at the expense of speed of permitting. I want to thank Representative Wasilek for hanging in there with this somewhat adversarial discussion, and I thank you for bringing this bill.
Representative Wadsworth, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for the good discussion. I know that there's some lingering questions, and I'm happy to answer those questions as we move forward. I do want to point out, Mr. Quillis said something about a hypothetical earlier, and what happened in my community with water gremlin was not a hypothetical. It actually happened. People in my community were exposed to high levels of a cancer-causing chemical for at least 2 decades, maybe longer, based on what we heard from the OLA report. It's not a hypothetical. It's a real thing that happened, and it's a real thing that we need to consider and that we need to take action on and do something about. This bill is one way that we can take action. It's one way to ensure that the rules we have in place for these facilities that pose great risks to human health and the environment, that they're actually following those rules, that they're doing the right thing. And we need to ensure that that happens, and this is one way that we can do that, and I would appreciate support as we move forward with this proposal. Thank you.
Representative Wadsworth renews her motion that House File 1037, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Members, thank you for your attention. We do have committee tomorrow at 8:30. We'll see you all then. This committee meeting is adjourned.